Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Spring is my favorite time to start a new workout routine. With the weather warming up, it feels easier to get into the rhythm of things. Whether you have 20 minutes or an hour for a Pilates class or outdoor guided walk, Peloton has everything you need to help you get going. Get a head start on summer with Peloton at onepeloton.com.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
I did some chaplaincy work for a very, very liberal arts college. Mm-hmm. And you know, people go around in a circle, you know, giving their pronouns. And I never once gave my pronouns. Mm-hmm. And if someone were to ask me, I was waiting for someone to confront me about it. No one ever did. Mm-hmm. If they were, I was ready. I say, I don't believe in giving pronouns. I don't believe I get to choose. Mm-hmm. And if you actually claim to believe in toleration, then you should tolerate my view.
Yes.
Which they don't. But yeah. that's a different thing, mm-hmm. you know. So we need to be ready to make these sacrifices.
Many Muslims living in the West have become aware that the ideas of tolerance, individualism, and liberal multiculturalism, freedom of religion, all liberal notions, have their limits when it comes to our community. A series of tensions from the depiction of the Messenger sallallahu alaihi wasallam in offensive cartoons and the teaching of sexual practices at odds with our faith in schools has brought into focus how there remains an incompatibility between the ever-increasing demands of the liberal state and the Muslim community. Now, to help us understand these tensions, I've asked Imam Tom Fakini, who converted to Islam in 2010, to discuss how Muslims relate to the liberal state. Imam Tom finished his BA in political science and was granted the opportunity to study at the Islamic University of Medina from 2015 to 2020, where he obtained his BA from the Faculty of Sharia. Imam Tom is currently the Research Director of Islam and Society at the Yaqeen Institute for Islamic Research. He is also the resident scholar and imam of Utica Masjid in New York State. Imam Tom, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah, and welcome to The Thinking Muslim.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thank you so much for having me.
Oh, it's so wonderful to have you with us. And it's been some time. I've been thinking to invite you on to talk about this subject for some time. So really, jazakallah khair for being with us here in Istanbul.
Amin wa yakum. Always happy to be here, and to be here together is even better.
Fantastic. Well, let's start with what I call the liberal inquisition. Now, you're a prominent imam in the United States. Paint a picture of the tensions within your community that may come out of the demands that the liberal state places upon Muslims.
Sure. After Bismillah, alhamdulillah, wa salatu salam rasulillah. You know, my community, I feel, first of all, I don't think I'm a prominent imam. I'm just an imam. But I think our community is fairly unique. I don't think that we feel as much of the rub or the force of the liberal state as other places do. Mm. That being said, there are definitely cracks or certain situations in which it comes about. Usually when it comes to, do people get the opportunity to pray in schools?
Right.
Now, on the books, yes, that's a right that's guaranteed to people, and they have the constitutional right to avail themselves of that. Mm. On the ground, the way in which that plays out is that the state and its, by extension, its sort of tentacles, whether it's in the education, you know, departments or what have you, are not strictly neutral.
Right.
There's a lot of sort of soft power that goes on that discourages children from praying. Mm-hmm. The same is true when it comes to getting holidays recognized. Even though, alhamdulillah, this year we did get a guarantee that Eid al-Fitr will be recognized as a school holiday locally
right.
for the following year, it's always something that needs to be negotiated. But of course, the big thing on everybody's minds, being June, is the issues around sexuality and gender. That's the real place where you see what about liberalism? Well, you see the mask comes off for what liberalism sort of truly is, despite its discourse as to what it would like people to think that it is.
Yes.
Versus its true reality, and also where it rubs up against sort of other ways of being, other metaphysics, other ontologies, Islam, when it rubs up against sort of what Islam calls us to do and calls us to be. So you have even the issue of pronouns,
right?
You have, and from the quote unquote progressive perspective, what's the harm in it, right? You say, you know, tell me what your pronouns are, and we're going to go around a circle and everybody says what their pronouns are.
Yeah.
And yet to be asked, even in the first place, rests upon a certain metaphysics that is very counter to Islam. Basically, they've set up a thought experiment and a situation that is a trap. You're damned if you do, you're damned if you don't. If you say, or I say, yes, my pronouns are he, him, I've implicitly recognized that I have the ability to choose, which completely violates Islamic belief and completely violates, you know, normative Islam, what we should be aspiring to. So those are the sorts of situations. And then obviously the things that get taught into class in classrooms about, you know, your relationship to your body, your relationship to your desires, how you should, you basically have a moral imperative to not only act on your desires, but to celebrate them, to identify with them, and to, you know, derive your self-worth from the expression of these desires. That's liberalism. And obviously that's all very, very counter to everything that Islam is about. So that's just a preview, I think.
Yeah, and I note that you've studied political science at university. You did your BA in political science in the States before you started on your traditional scholarship journey at Medina University. So let's discuss liberalism. Many Muslims may still be under the impression that liberalism allows you to be who you want to be. Why is the liberal state demanding so much from Muslims?
Yeah, there's a couple of reasons for that. First of all, the key to how you phrase the question that shows us the answer is that you said the liberal state, okay? Because liberalism is one thing, it's an ideology, but when you bring into the conversation the liberal state, you're giving recognition to the fact that the ideology is nothing without force in order to make it, to instantiate it, to make it real, right? To make it concrete. And so there's sort of an ideological element to liberalism, which has suppositions, but it also has a sort of discourse that is very, you know, appealing to people, right? Yeah. It talks about certain values that it has, and it presents a smiling face to people when it comes to what it has to believe. But the devil in the details is that it always requires the state to recognize those values and enforce them and to protect them against other sort of forces that would challenge those values.
Okay.
And so when it comes to why Muslims in particular, there's a couple of reasons. First of all, because there is something very fundamental to Islam that contradicts the basis of liberalism, and that is the autonomy versus submission divide, right? Liberalism, if you want to summarize it in one word, it's all about autonomy.
Right.
It's all about being able to do what you want, or as you said in the question, to be what you want, which is kind of an ideological extension of that. Whereas Islam is literally means submission. Okay. So that implies some of the time not doing what you want. It actually implies subordinating your desires to some sort of external regime of values that's not derived from what you feel. And then actually the goal, the imperative of Islam is to bring your internal desires in line and in conformity with those values, which is totally illiberal, unliberal, anti-liberal project. So that's just one thing. There's more real politic and sort of current events issues that has to do with sort of what the state perceives as its enemies, its existential enemies, and obviously 9/11 and afterwards the war on terror, things like that. Islam and Muslims are sort of, you know, looked at with a suspicious eye, a potential fifth column, things like that. But there's something that's more interesting, which has to do with the ways in which Islam has not yet been secularized, right? Which puts Muslims in particular the crosshairs of liberalism.
So explain that. What do you mean by Islam has not been secularized?
Yes, exactly. So, you know, every sort of ideology, as we said, relies on a certain wielding or use of power, deployment of power in order to bring about its objectives.
Yeah.
So liberalism relies on the state, okay, yes, but not just the state. There's also secularization.
Okay.
Secularization is the force that makes other value systems able to be governed and participate, quote unquote, within liberal society.
Right.
So once Christianity, for example, has been sufficiently secularized, it can participate in liberal society. You imagine sort of like cutting a cloth, okay? It's like there's a certain amount of the cloth that liberalism is willing to keep, right? And then there's other things that are outside that it is not willing to keep. And so you have to go through this shearing process if you're going to be granted legitimacy and equal participation within the system.
Yeah,
this is the complaint of all the sort of quote-unquote Islamophobes, and I don't necessarily like the discourse of Islamophobia. I think it's problematic, but it gets at something that's true and real, is that people, you know, they complain that Islam is not compatible with modernity, or Islam is not compatible with liberalism.
Yes.
And in a way, they're right. It's true when we talk about values, right? Not that I don't belong in the United States of America, not that I don't belong in 2023, right? But when we're talking about what are liberal values value autonomy and sort of, again, all this sort of constellation of how you relate to your desires and how you should bring them about. And if you don't, you're sort of living this conflicted existence and maybe you're going to fall into depression or something like that. Islam is not those values. Islam is something completely other than that. And it has not yet undergone the secularization forces completely. It's in progress and we're trying to fight it.
Yeah.
But Christianity has been thoroughly secularized. You look at, in America, we have some sects of Christianity that are quite, let's say, fringe, such as the Amish.
Right.
Okay, so the Amish have done something, and other groups like them, where they have resisted the forces of secularization. But look at the cost, right? The cost is that they are not given participation in society. They're invisible when it comes to the world stage, except for, you know, occasionally they run some sort of TV series where it's like sort of like, oh, a freak show, look at them, they're so weird, right? So this is an example of a group that has attempted to resist secularization, has for the most part succeeded in that, but it demonstrates the costs as well. So the big chess match that's going on is, okay, liberals and people who are, you know, acting in the favor or in the interest of the liberal state are attempting to secularize Islam and Muslims, which is why they have an interest. They're not neutral, right? And that's the key point. They're not neutral on what type of Muslim you are. They're what type of Muslim I am. We have the Rand Report. We have, you know, all these sorts of things that indicate that the government is invested in producing, and this is why secularism also lies to the people with the face it presents, right? By saying that it's about separation of church and state. Yeah. No, it's about producing a certain type of acceptable religiosity. Acceptable to whom? Acceptable to the liberal state. So, you know, that's why the government has an interest in saying, well, we want a certain progressive Islam or a moderate Islam. And we're going to throw money at this group and this group and Muslims for progressive values and all these sorts of things.
Yeah.
Like they deliberately are trying to create a certain type of Muslim, a certain type of Islam that is fully subjectable, or we should say able to be subordinated,
right,
and able to be governed and managed in the way that a liberal modern state expects to be able to govern and manage.
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, of course, liberals would argue, well, what we call for is a very slimmed down version of human existence. We believe in a form of universalism that everyone can sign up to. We believe in a state that remains neutral and doesn't side with any of the key decisions of what human beings would regard to be a choice to fulfill the good life, right?
Yeah.
To get to a stage in their life where the state does not favor one side or the other, but actually stands as a neutral arbiter. You're arguing that there is nothing neutral about liberalism. Explain that to me.
Oh, fantastic. Yeah, no, there is no such thing as neutrality.
Right.
Not even the fact that liberalism is not neutral, that neutrality can't possibly exist, because all of the terms that you mentioned, being a human, what is good, what is life?
Right.
You have to have a certain conception and definition of what those things are.
Yeah.
And there's going to be a certain metaphysics that undergirds your definition of those things.
Okay.
Right. Recently, I gave a talk about human rights at ICNA. And my point was, everybody, their attention goes to the rights part of human rights, and they forget about the human part of human rights.
Right.
Because actually how you define what a human being is going to completely determine what rights you think they're entitled to.
Right.
Right. So when it comes to what type of human does the liberal ideology or the liberal state imagine, it is a secular, materialistic definition of a human being.
Right.
They assume as a metaphysical stance that a real human being has only a material existence, that they don't have an afterlife, that there is no God,
sure.
that, you know, there is no moral right or wrong in the thick sense of morality that, that faith teaches.
Yes.
And so everything else is seen as dispensable, disposable, separatable, right? Which is exactly where that's the power move, right? To be able to define what is essential and what is not essential is exactly where liberal power exists.
Yes.
So that's not neutral, right? Like I'm saying that God exists. We have, there's heaven and hell. We have an afterlife. And that totally determines, in the example of human rights, what rights I think I'm entitled to. And it also determines what I think of as good. Somebody who thinks that there is no afterlife, this is the only thing that they have, right? And so that's where you get, you know, materialists are much more concerned about autonomy and free choice and pursuing pleasure and these sorts of things, because it's a very maximalist disposition towards this life, because that's all they have, right? That's downstream from their idea of what human life is, what is a human and what is life.
Yeah.
Somebody who believes in an afterlife, they believe in heaven and hell. You know, we're willing to be patient in this life and deprive ourselves and discipline ourselves in this life because we know that there's something after, right? And that creates a whole different conversation around rights and what I think I'm entitled to. I'm not entitled any longer to do whatever I want and to experience whatever I want to experience or to act on every single pleasure or act on every single desire that comes my way, because I believe that I'm not living for this life. I'm living for something that's beyond, and I believe in a deity that I actually, my success, ultimate success, depends upon my conformity to the regime of values and instructions and prohibitions and et cetera, obligations that are imposed by that deity.
I mean, give me an example of a right that liberalism gives you, which you would contest to be not really a valid right in Islam.
Oh, sure. I mean, you know, everything around sexuality that people are talking about these days, right? The idea, quote unquote, love is love, right?
Okay.
There's no better slogan for liberal ideas towards sexuality than love is love.
Yeah.
The subtext and the idea behind that is that love is something supposedly so sacred. And again, that's shaped by our definition of what is a human being. Human beings are material.
Yes.
Okay. They're not, there's no soul. There is no God. There is no afterlife. So they say. So your fulfillment is limited to this world. What are the things that are going to achieve satisfaction and fulfillment in this only life that you have?
Yeah.
The most sacred thing to you, the most natural sort of inseparable thing to you, is your sexuality, right? And so therefore, if you have sexual desires, your sense of fulfillment and satisfaction and even sort of completion as a human being, right, as a willful, autonomous agent, is to act on them and satisfy them.
Yeah.
Right. And so that's where we get the idea of identifying with your desires. And now you have a whole identity that's sort of based upon who you're attracted to or what you're attracted to or whatever. Right. And to deny yourself, right, the exercise of that desire and of that want, you live like a damned life. You got cognitive dissonance and you're probably going to fall into depression and you might kill yourself and, you know, all these sorts of things. Right. So this is the antithesis of what it is to be liberal, right? Self-denial in this type of way.
Right. That's interesting. I mean, I'm still trying to understand the tensions that exist between the Muslim community on the one hand and the liberal state on the other. So for example, in Europe, I mean, that's my reality. We have got a situation where Muslim parents, say in France, are denied the right to teach their children at home. It's now compulsory to send your child to state school, because lots of Muslims were withdrawing their kids from basic education, from state education, because they feared the liberal state and its incursion into the lives of ordinary Muslims. Mosques have been shut down across Europe, and again, very notably in France, charities have been closed down. Now, how do we reconcile these actions with the professed notion of toleration that is also fundamental to liberalism? I mean, John Locke talked about toleration as a fundamental liberal virtue. Is it that liberals have forsaken some of their values Or is there something more, is there something intrinsic within liberalism that I don't know, that limits how much toleration they can offer to other communities?
I mean, I think that there's something always limited in tolerance or toleration that's just inherent, whether it's liberalism or otherwise. Liberalism is simply the only ideology that pretends to have an absolute notion of toleration,
right?
Or at least maybe not in theoretical book liberalism, but at least how it's perceived within the culture. And so when it comes to, tolerating others, you have to realize that, well, what are the bounds? What are the parameters of toleration? It's never absolute. It can't possibly be absolute because that would be self-defeating. Can a liberal state tolerate groups that want to destroy the state? No, absolutely not. You know, that's why there's counterterrorism, quote unquote. That's why there's the FBI and the CIA, MI6, right? All these organs that are supposed to identify threats and truly existential threats, even though they cast their net much broader than that, in order to mitigate this sort of potential threat. So toleration is never an absolute. There's always bounds. So and the shifting of the question to black or white, yes or no, is an ideological move, right? To get you to feel warm fuzzies about liberalism, because liberalism is about tolerance and this other thing is intolerance. Tolerance and intolerance. Oh, who, if that's your choice, then of course everyone's going to choose tolerance. Yeah. What kind of jerk would choose intolerance? But that's not really what's going on, really. And Talal Esed says this very well. He says that it's not merely an increase in freedom or an increase in tolerance. It's merely a different pattern of constraint. Right. So what are the patterns or what are the values upon which we're constraining people?
Right.
What's shaping what are our criteria for who we're going to tolerate and who we aren't going to tolerate?
Yes.
That's where the secularization piece comes in, because liberalism, yes, will tolerate any religion or faith or whatever that has been secularized. Okay. Once it has shed those parts of it that the liberal state deems as existentially threatening, either the personality of the state. And that doesn't even have to be the literal state itself. It could be even the personality of the state, which is what France does. Any sort of thing that expresses that it's contrary to the French essence.
Yes.
Right? Like that's the idea. It's not literally like challenging to overthrow the government, but it's the idea that it's challenging the personality of the state.
Right.
That will not be tolerated. It can't be tolerated. And so it needs to go through the secularization process in order to gain entry into the arena of tolerance. Right? So if you're being tolerated, it's already too late in that sense.
There will be some Muslims who argue that, well, maybe that's a price worth paying. We are maybe first generation, second generation in Europe, in America, maybe even possibly third generation Muslims. But in order to make our home in the West, because the Muslim world is so chaotic, we are going to have to compromise somewhat with the liberal state. I mean, how would you respond to that compromise that naturally the liberal state seeks from citizens who seek a better economic and social life?
Yeah, there's a gradient, right? So there's always sort of like there are degrees of compromise, and some might be justifiable and others certainly are not, right? So when we talk about the extent to which I'm talking about, we're saying the state comes in and produces the religion such that we've lost what Islam is,
right?
And that's why some people have said that, you know, Muslims are between a rock and a hard place, because the political right wants to wipe out Muslims and the political left wants to wipe out Islam, right? And so there, if you allow the secularization process to go unchecked, if you fully submit to it, if that's your idea of what compromise looks like, there will be no Islam left. You won't necessarily realize it. You will call it Islam. You will think that you're living Islam. But in fact, it's been chopped up. It's been rearranged. It's just sort of, you know, whether it's, if Christianity, for example, is any sort of analog, it will be limited to private worship and, you know, private belief. And we ditch a lot of the fiqh that has to do with building society and justice and inheritance and these sorts of things. You know, they would all sort of become released to, you know, what the state deems. That's not the only compromise that's possible to be made. That's like sort of on the far side.
Right.
There are other compromises that might be more justifiable, such as even to accept citizenship in the first place is a type of compromise.
Yes.
Right. Like they say, make you promise that you're never going to, you know, raise arms, you're going to be politically loyal and you're going to do this and you're going to that. You know, that's a political compromise that might be more justifiable depending on the situation. For me, I don't have to think about those things because I was born in the United States. I never had to go through a citizenship test and have my, you know, swearing of allegiance or things like that. But merely living in the West, You know, there's enough space, at least I can talk from the American context, the United States, there's enough space to maneuver where you can live and actually establish Islam to some extent, and hold on to it as it truly is, right? And not in some sort of post-secularized version, without necessarily going to the, you know, to the extent where we're going to compromise at that level.
Is that space narrowing, especially in the democratic-run states?
Yeah, so it differs. So definitely, I mean, and it takes priorities and it takes sacrifices. So I'll say that if your modus operandi is to come to the United States and you want to have both spouses work and have salaried incomes, and you want to send the kids to public school, and you want to, you're probably going to lose Islam. That's just statistics.
SubhanAllah, really?
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, that's my opinion, and I haven't been proven wrong yet.
Yeah.
You know, we're talking about you. Because also what happens is that people choose where they live. Yeah. So and the criteria upon which people are basing their decisions are not Islamic or moral criteria. They're, you know, what's the best school district, or what's the, you know, the richest neighborhood, or the nicest neighborhood, or whatever. They don't care about their neighbors. They don't care about being close to the masjid. They don't care about these sorts of things.
Yeah.
And so if that's your process of decision making, then it's just a matter of time, honestly, until Islam is gone. But no one's forcing you to do that, right? You can exist in the United States and you can choose to live next to the masjid or close to the masjid. You can choose to be in a neighborhood. Maybe it doesn't have the best school district, but you know that you have a critical mass of Muslim culture, a critical mass of Muslim playmates for your kids, potential spouses for your kids in the future, things like this. And then there's institutions, and being on the ground level and building these institutions, whether they're madrasas or, you know, Islamic schools, or even the programs that run out of the masjid. I was just talking to a good friend of mine, and he said that when it comes to, his son is 17, and he has sort of through the mosque, there's this organization called YM that does a lot of like youth programming and stuff like that. But he does go to public school. And so he was joking to me. He said he has friends that are Anthony and Carlos and whatever at public school. And you know, those can be Muslim names. I'm not making that point here, but in this situation, they're not Muslims. And then he has friends through the mosque. And then, so he's communicated to his son, those friends that you have at school, they are only your friends when you're in school. You're not hanging out with them outside of school. You're not going over their houses on the weekdays. You're not going to the mall with them. Your real friends that you're going to have are the friends of the mosque.
Right.
And in fact, that's what he's done. And he's had a lot of success.
Okay.
So it takes this type of intentionality, right? And we suffer as Muslims and as Muslim parents from a lack of intentionality when it comes to the decisions that we make, and forethought and planning, to be able to survive and not survive physically. We're good with that.
And of course, liberals will see that as overbearing parenting, and you know, this is going against the autonomy of the child, right? Yeah, that's really interesting. I mean, actually, tell me something about, I'm intrigued with what you said there, because in the UK, we have got second, third generation Muslims. But by and large, Muslims who went to state schools, majority of Muslims have, you know, been through the state school system. They remained Muslims. And yes, there may be different grades, and Allah knows best. There may be different grades of, you know, of practicing Muslims. But generally speaking, we don't really have an epidemic of apostasy as I'm not sure if I don't want to put words in your mouth, but it seems like, you know, from generation to generation, we could be losing people in the United States.
I think the stats say quarter of Muslims will not be Muslims by the time they're adults. Yes.
That's amazing, really.
It is. It's staggering.
So what's the difference? I mean, these are both liberal states.
Yes.
They both have very assertive programs to secularize and to liberalize their citizens, yet the American experience is far more successful for the liberal state than, say, the British experience.
Right.
Any ideas?
Off the cuff, I mean, I would assume that maybe Muslim populations are probably more concentrated in the UK.
For sure.
And so there's always going to be, you know, counterculture.
Yes.
Right? And here's another thing, too, and we were talking about this off camera, about the different sort of socioeconomic you know, identity or background of the populations. You know, we have everything in the United States, but when it comes to economic migrants, especially that are of an upper class, they tend to be more interested in assimilation. They tend to be have more dunyawi goals.
Yeah.
Right. And so those sorts of things, right? If you have isolation, parents literally make the choice between especially in our area, between putting their child in a much poorer school district, but with a significant Muslim population, and that has, you know, even some teachers that are Muslims, and has a sort of a Muslim camaraderie, right? That is not a complete inoculation, but something that is significantly maybe blunts the damage or the reach of the logic of the state and that state education and things like that.
Yeah.
Versus right across the border adjacent is a suburb that is way wealthier, school system is rated much higher, and your child will be the only Muslim in the class.
Wow, okay.
And if your child is the only Muslim in the class for 9, 10 out of 12 grades, you can imagine the psychological damage and the ideological damage that this does to a person. That's my hot take, but
I think it's probably quite accurate, actually. And you're right, in the UK and in France, Muslims tend to live together, and they tend to live in very concentrated communities, and you can't avoid Muslims. And as you said, in state schools you have a high concentration of Muslims. I'm thinking of Birmingham and Bradford. Talked to you about Bradford the other day, which is an extension of Pakistan, really, rather than England. Let me ask you a question about, so we've talked so far about the liberal state. Mm-hmm. Now, in the context of the United States, the word liberal is reserved for progressives, for the Democrats. Mm-hmm. How do we see the Republicans vis-a-vis liberalism?
Yes. No, that's a good question. And it comes back to kind of a historical point about like capital L liberalism versus lowercase L liberalism. So, but it's revealing because the progressive conservative split or Democrat, Republic, whatever have you, reveals a significant tension within liberalism, or at least in liberalism's relationship with the state.
Okay.
Because liberalism as an ideology is predicated upon autonomy.
Hmm.
And autonomy is about choosing what you want to do, doing whatever you want, etc. Hmm. Or we could say, to be more precise, removing the barriers that might encroach or limit your choices.
Okay.
Or force you to choose something, God forbid.
Yeah.
However, for human life and satisfaction, it's not merely enough to be able to do what you want. You, first of all, rely upon the state and the violence of the state, the force of the state, its laws, its police, its judges, whatever, to be able to make those choices in the first place, to guarantee that space, to carve out that space where you're able to exercise that autonomy. Mm. But then in another sense, you also rely upon the state and its violence and everything else in order to recognize you in some of your decisions and your free choices. And so we see this with sexuality, and we see this with the quote unquote LGBT quote unquote community. For them, it's not enough to just simply exercise their autonomy in the sense of doing what they want in the bedroom.
Yeah.
Right. Or you want to call yourself anything you want, any pronoun, any name, whatever. That's not enough.
Right.
They want to force recognition. They want to be not just identify, which is their buzzword. They want to be identified, right? They want to be identifiable. They want other people to identify how they identify them as. You can't do this without the state.
Yes.
Right? So the progressive conservative split mirrors this sort of tension. So the progressive idea is that, you know, we need to be identifiable in order to have this sort of human satisfaction.
Mm.
It's not merely enough to choose the thing that I want. I actually depend upon others and the recognition of others to be, you know, satisfied in that choice. Whereas conservatives are more along the line of, leave me alone, I will pursue my own happiness and do it in the way that I want. And I don't necessarily, I'm not as invested in, or at least let's say we can pinpoint the idea of what is good, right? So the emphasis of what is good for a conservative is less dependent upon recognition from others.
Right.
Right. Whereas the definition of what is good or what is fulfilling or satisfactory or whatever for progressives is much more dependent upon the recognition from others.
Right.
And so therefore relies upon the force of the state in a much thicker way than conservatives do.
But they both accept autonomy as a very basic liberal
value.
Exactly.
And that's what makes them both liberal.
They're both liberal, right. Okay, that's really interesting. Because of course, in the US context, we can easily say the liberals are the Democrats in New York and not, you know, Ron DeSantis in Florida or whoever, right?
Most people, they associate liberalism not with the classical ideology. They associate it with the current sort
political
of democratic
parties.
Progressivist.
Right. Okay, that's really important. So there is a stark difference between, having said that, between New York and California on the one hand and Florida and Texas on the other. So Ron DeSantis, governor of Florida, has banned gender identity discussions in schools and has censored a number of books in public state schools and has banned, you know, critical race theory. That's debatable whether that's what that is, and but they've banned it. Explain this to me. What's going on here?
Well, politically, you know, the United States is a federation of states, right? So we have something that's fairly unique, I think, in that the state is not as centralized as other liberal states. And so there is some room for the manifestation of the different types of liberalism, right, on the state level. And as, again, we were discussing earlier, there's sort of things become a major deal and derive a lot of attention or attract a lot of attention when they try to cross over from the state to the federal level. So you'll see all sorts of things that are approved at the state level. But then to make it a national thing that now everybody on across the board has to, that's why Roe versus Wade was such a big deal. That's why repealing it was such a big deal. You know, repealing it didn't do anything except kick it back to the states. Now, once again, it's a state issue and not a federal issue. And the same thing with you know, quote unquote gay marriage, right? In 2015, what was there were states that recognized gay marriage before that. However, it was not a federal issue, right? It was raised to the level of the national government. It was approved, and then everybody has to fall in line and conform. So that's kind of structurally what's going on, is that that arrangement allows for the different manifestations of the different emphases of what are we saying is good here? What's the good life? You know, where is human satisfaction found? And the Republican states put more of an emphasis on government getting out of the way. Again, that's a caveat. It's a simplification, not always, but in general, suspicion towards the government getting involved in anything. Basic assumption being that when they get involved in something, they're going to ruin it or do it less efficiently or et cetera. Versus sort of the progressive emphasis on good being, you know, some sort of proactive social justice agenda that relies on people recognizing certain values and enshrining certain recognitions of identities and things like that, that goes for a much more aggressive and muscular sort of, you know, government intervention.
Is the U.S. Constitution a liberal constitution?
Yes, it is, in the classical sense of what that means, in that it's focused on autonomy. You have the, you know, freedom of life, liberty, life, and the pursuit of happiness, or however it's written, right? You see, you know, the idea of the Bill of Rights, the right to your own property, the right to the freedom of speech and the freedom of religion. All these things are based on liberalism, you know, when it comes to the political ideology of what liberalism is.
That's, again, interesting, because, of course, when we, in political science, when we consider the U.S. Constitution, we always pair it up with neutral. It's a neutral constitution. You know, it seeks to create a level playing field between its citizens. Your argument is that it isn't. It is very...
It wasn't possible, even from the beginning. And there's descriptive historical reasons for why that can't be true, right? Such as, you know, the slavery issue and, you know, three-fifths clause and things like that. Like, and then women's suffrage and stuff like that. You know, definitely not, let's say, a... completely faithful or logically coherent, maybe, manifestation of liberalism's sort of tenets. But then again, when liberalism was first formulated, they weren't thinking about those things. When Locke was talking, he wasn't thinking about slaves or Africans or African descendants. He wasn't thinking about women, right? And so that was no contradiction to them. They were thinking about all of these things in parentheses. And that should also, you know, add to our discussion of tolerance and toleration as to what a limited and narrow thing that we're actually talking about when we're talking about liberal tolerance. But yeah, I mean, strictly speaking, it's not neutral. I mean, everything, again, if you use the word human being, you have to have an implicit understanding of what is a human being. You have to make metaphysical claims, whether they're explicit or implicit, about what are we doing here? What's the purpose of human life? Where do we get satisfaction from? What does it mean to live a good life? What is the good, right? What is the relationship between the government and people in realizing that good,
right?
Many of those assumptions, except for the last one that I just mentioned, you know, liberalism has qawl wahid, right? It has like one one statement on those things, and it's not particularly broad. It's not universal, definitely not universal. It's not... you know, it's actually very controversial, and it's very narrow, and it has very specific claims that any conscientious Muslim would say, wait a second, that's actually not what I believe, right? Even though, okay, that's the political regime that we live under, and now we have to negotiate rights within that matrix and things like that. That's a separate issue. But if we were in an Aqidah class or a situation where you're asked as a Muslim, do you believe in A or do you believe in B? And A is liberalism and the liberal idea of what a human being is, and there's no afterlife, and there's no God, or maybe there's a God, but we're not going to really talk about that right here. You can talk about it in the church or in the mosque or whatever. Versus, no, we believe that the Sharia is the best system for human beings through all times and all places. No concerns. We believe that there is only one God, and to worship anything other than Allah is shirk, and you're in danger in the afterlife. And all these sort of prescriptive, normative beliefs that we have, right? Muslims will choose B, inshallah. If you're a conscientious Muslim, you should be choosing the latter.
Yes.
However, your politically navigated day-to-day life, if you're living in a place that's under a liberal regime, then you have to navigate and you have to appeal for your rights and get out. You're just like the mashayikh and the ulama, they talk about the situation of bribery, right? Is that their bribery is haram, okay? But if you can't achieve your right, you can't get your right except by paying a bribe, then okay, it becomes halal for you and you have to do it actually in order to get your right. Okay, we don't believe in these liberal values. We don't believe in the idea, the liberal idea of a human being, the idea of the ontology, of the afterlife, the cosmology, all these things. Yet here we are. We find ourselves under a liberal regime, and that's the only matrix within which we can obtain our legal rights. And so that's what we have to refer to.
Yeah, that again, so you know, what you described there is the practical life that a Muslim leads. Now, let's talk about the practice then of Muslims. You know, you could work under an employer who is gay.
Right.
You could be a teacher or a lecturer at university, and inevitably you're going to have to accept that there are social norms in the classroom, in the lecture theatre, that in some on some level you're going to have to acquiesce to. Otherwise, you'll be sacked from your job, as we found with a number of lecturers in recent months and years who have been sacked for even voicing the most mildest objections to, you know, gender pronouns, for example. So how much, where are the red lines? Yes. How much should a Muslim acquiesce with the demands, the current demands, let's put it like that, of the liberal state?
Well, let's put it this way. We should be thankful that the liberal state still doesn't banish us or kick us out, or it's not a crime to deny these sorts of things. So obviously, you know, and the ulama and the mashayikh, they talk about this when they talk about what is darura, like what is like a true necessity.
Yeah.
And they define it by life and limb.
Okay.
Right? Life and limb situation.
And we're
nowhere
near that.
We're nowhere near that. Right. Alhamdulillah. So actually the situation calls for courage, and it calls for moral bravery and sacrifice, to be honest. It's like, you know, I did some chaplaincy work for a very, very liberal arts college. Mm. And you know, people go around in a circle, you know, giving their pronouns. And I never once gave my pronouns. And if someone were to ask me, I was waiting for someone to confront me about it. No one ever did. If they were, I was ready. I say, I don't believe in giving pronouns. I don't believe I get to choose. And if you actually claim to believe in toleration, then you should tolerate my view, which they don't. But that's a different thing, you know. So we need to be ready to make these sacrifices. Now, if you're in a situation, alhamdulillah, I'm in a situation where I've hedged in various directions. And so I'm not dependent on that for, you know, my income and things like that. If you're in a situation where you're completely dependent upon that, then you might need to have a sequential plan of how to get in a certain situation where you're able to live according to your beliefs, right? Maybe if something's going to get you fired, then maybe you start looking for another job, you know, before necessarily causing a scene and things like that. But I do think, you know, the mufti always has to take into account the situation where people are, and seeing, are people leaning too far to this side or too far to that side? If we were leaning too much towards belligerence, then I would maybe tell people, hey guys, let's pump the brakes. Let's, you know, like,
why, you know, isn't that Amr bil Ma'ruf wa Nahy al Munkar? Isn't that being, you know, brave, as you said?
Well, it can be, but it's often not, right? Because we have to consider, you know, put our dawah hats on for a second. And you have to, you know, if you cause a scene and you don't necessarily, even you're not doing dawah, you're just sort of having this chest thumping moment where you're not really addressing the underlying concerns, right? Consider that the dawah of the Prophet Muhammad Sallallahu Alaihi Wasallam was all founded upon trust.
Yes.
Right? He was known as Al-Amin. That was his nickname. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala references in the Quran and Surah Al-A'raf that your people know you. You grew up with them. So the level of responsibility and duty that those people had to respond to that call is just, you know, 100%. That's their duty. They have to. And if they're not, they're liars. They're insincere. They're phony. Right? They're hypocrites and kidding themselves. You at your job, you know, or me at my job, you know, if we're okay, we haven't reached that level of trust perhaps, and maybe we are just kind of awkward and we don't have relationships and things like that, we're in a weaker position. right, when it comes to that. So the situation doesn't call for grandstanding.
Right.
Okay. It you should be principled, 100%. Always be principled. Never don't be principled. But you need to, as Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says elsewhere in the Quran, you know, argue with that which is better, right? And maw'idha hasana, right? With you know, beautiful speech and good speech. Mm. And so if someone comes to you, right, and they don't understand, they're ignorant, they think that this is justice.
Yeah.
They think that in their world that this is toleration, that this is like the best possible thing. Mm. Right. And there are people that are legitimately shocked when you explain to them that this actually completely excludes me. This actually completely violates my beliefs. Mm. And I refuse to go along with it. You know, there are some people that are ignorant enough to be like, wow, you're the first person to tell me that. Mm. So we have a moral duty to be that first person, right? And that's why I say, you know, rather than necessarily, you know, if we had a problem with being belligerent, then I would suggest people to maybe tone it down and be the opposite. But we have, the reality is that we have the opposite problem.
True.
We have people that are exhibiting cowardice in these moments and not taking into account the intergenerational effects and the psychological effects, right? We need people to take a stand. We need people to say that it's not a crime to believe in what I believe. And, you know, if it were a crime, then we would need to address that too, but it's not right now. It's not a crime. Mm. And so I believe this, there's only two genders, that marriage is this, you know, this is what it means to be a man, this is what it means to be a woman. And to ask me to capitulate to anything else is morally wrong, and I'm not going to do it. Okay. And if that requires me leaving my job, then I'll do it. You know, Allah is the provider. So that's where we're at. We're too much on this side. And so I encourage the people to try to be as brave as possible while being respectful. Be principled, be respectful, and try to communicate clearly that this is something that we are never going to sign off on.
But that does require a certain level of communication skills. It requires a discourse which maybe is missing within the Muslim communities. I mean, you're an imam of a mosque. How much is it your responsibility, as well as all of us, but your responsibility to explain to Muslims how to courteously be brave?
Oh, definitely. And that's why we rely on leadership. And that's why documents like the Navigating Differences document are important. Mm. Although it was misunderstood, you know, for reasons, you know, that not entirely blameless for the framers of that document as well, because, you know, they didn't make clear the intent behind the document. But this is the exact type of situation that this document was crafted for. Mm. So that somebody, they don't know the Quran, they don't know the Hadith, maybe they're not well-spoken, maybe they're not really sure all the proofs and things like that, or what language to use, what discourse to use, whatever. Mm-hmm. Here's a paper, give it to them. You know, you can say, this is what I believe, I'm not going to do anything. Yeah. Don't worry, it doesn't mean I'm going to hurt you, right? Which is some people's fear, and we try to address that in the document. But I'm not going to sign up. I'm not going to sign on. I'm not going to recognize. I'm not going to celebrate. I'm not going to affirm. This is beyond what I can do.
Yeah. Back to the discussion about the Liberal Inquisition. Why have other communities, you know, be it the Catholic community, the Jewish community, the Hindu community, why have they found it much more easier to embrace liberal modernity? They've worked out, I suppose, what Rawls calls an overlapping consensus with the liberal state. What is it within Islam and Muslims that pushes back against this sort of liberal encroachment into our lives?
Yeah, it's a good question. First of all, there is no overlapping consensus as Rawls would have it, because that would make it seem like they were equal partners in negotiation. You know, you at a table and me at a table, and we have a nice cup of chai and we negotiate sort of our, you know, our contractual rights. And that's not descriptive of the scenario at all. Mm. The power is all with one side. There's no power on the other side. And so it's more of one side putting a gun to the other side's head and saying, well, if you want entry into this thing, this is what you're going to do. Or else it's a shakedown, right? A stick up. And so what is the nature of the stick up? That's the secularization, right? So all of those communities have already been secularized. You go to the Catholic Church, you look at Vatican II in the 60s, and it is a complete unmooring and abandonment of traditional principles, traditional epistemology even. So then, you know, everything else downstream now is just real politics. Now it's just adjusting to, okay, this society now is about love and tolerance and et cetera. That's what we're going to be. Mm-hmm. We're going to now use that. Those are what are real. And now our tradition is malleable, and we're going to interact with that tradition and cherry pick from that tradition and interpret that tradition in light of these unquestionable assumptions and values that modern society is having. Mm-hmm. That's what the Catholic Church is right now. right? And Protestantism had undergone that secularization process already when it came to the 1920s and, you know, the early part of the 20th century when it came to the evangelical mainline split, right? You had a, you know, evolution and Big Bang and these things were happening. You had a huge split in the mainline Protestant churches, or it happened to Protestant churches, at least in the United States, that they basically had to decide, are we going to try to cling to some sort of non-secularized part of our faith, or are we going to say, okay, white flag, right? We give up. You're right. Science has it. Modernity has it. You know, liberal values, and we're going to interact with our tradition again in a very selective and not sort of subordinate way, in a sort of manipulative way, in order to conform with, instead of traditional guidance, we're now conforming with whatever modern values and sort of trends are happening. Mm. So all these communities already went under these, for Jewish community, World War II, after World War II and, you know, the Holocaust, you know, a huge number of Jews were atheists, there's no Rawlsian consensus. The faith has been beaten out of them, you know? And so they don't have, a strong, and there's pockets of resistance, et cetera, but we're talking about the general thrust. The general thrust is that things have become subordinated to the state. Interesting thing while we're on the topic is that while the evangelical sort of part, or the evangelical movement sort of cleaved off from Protestantism, you know, opposed to the mainline churches, and they resisted, I think, secularization in the short term, they capitulated in the long term,
right,
when they got into, you know, their politics now, or their religion is basically the politics of the state, right? Mm. Their God is America, right? At least in the United States. And neoconservatism and the blurring of these lines, to the point where you saw how they reacted to Trump, and Trump was their savior, even though he was a wicked man, an immoral individual.
Yes.
And so how can this tension be resolved, or how can these two things simultaneously exist? Hmm. They have been secularized. They didn't realize it, how it happened, you know, as opposed to maybe Vatican II, very, purposeful.
Yes.
But slowly but surely they were overcome with political, interests and calculations, to the point where the politics became the guiding force and the tradition and the faith was not.
Hmm.
We're still resisting. Hmm. We're still resisting this process, and we're in a very, very crucial historical window where it's either going to make or break us. Like this, we're actually going right through now what the Protestant church went through,
right,
and what the Catholics went through. And we're seeing now, and the LGBTQ thing and the sexuality is really sort of, you know, what really is forcing the issue, because we have people who are identifying as Muslims who have abandoned Islam,
right?
That are literally, they've dug out and emptied Islam out from all normative and prescriptive content. Mm-hmm. And now their quote unquote Islam is only what are the modern ideologies, slogans, trends of today.
Mm-hmm.
If you say that Islam is mercy, then it's mercy according to the modern society. If you say Islam is justice, it's justice according to the modern standard definition of justice. It's not, we're not submitting ourselves to the tradition, we're submitting ourselves to the what's popular in society.
Yeah.
We're seeing people like that now. In large numbers. Alhamdulillah, I don't think the majority, but we're seeing people like that in large numbers.
Mm-hmm.
And how we navigate this window of time is going to determine probably the history of the Muslim community in the West, you know, in the UK, in Europe, in the United States. How many people are we going to be able to bring back? How many people are we going to be able to, you know, elucidate the dynamics and what's at stake in this thing, so that they are still submitting not to modern society and modern society standards, but submitting to Allah and his guidance, right? Conforming themselves with the sunnah of the Prophet Sallallahu Alaihi Wasallam and not the sunnah of mainstream society. So it's partly just because historically we're newer, right? That's part of the reason why Islam has this sort of position. We have to learn from the mistakes that the previous communities made. We have to be aware of this process that's going on.
Yeah.
But if anything is going to challenge the liberal project of secularization, then it would be Islam. Islam is the only faith community, whatever you want to call it, that has the chops, that has the, you know, the thing in it that can actually not just resist, but also respond and undermine and answer the liberal project. Liberal project says autonomy, free choice, freedom, et cetera, et cetera. We say submission, obedience, righteousness, piety. And the ways in which what we have in Islam is much thicker than the things that they had in Christianity or Judaism or other communities to be able to respond to that.
So how much then do we contribute to the broader discussions within liberal society, we can call it post-liberalism, we can call it the polarization that exists, and that's developing. And, and you know, we can now see that American society is tearing itself apart, right? Oh, yeah. Some have argued that it's on the brink of a civil war, at least it's moving in that direction. How much can the Muslim community contribute in a positive way to that debate about the future of the liberal state?
Yeah, I mean, these are things that we're discussing and arguing about every day. And different people who I respect a lot, you know, have different takes on this than I do. My particular take is that we can participate as much as possible when it comes to shaping the discourse, because I believe that liberalism, because it is man-made, because it is based on kufr, it's based off of things that contradict Islam, it has tangible negative consequences. You look at the isolation that people feel, the loneliness, the fracturing of the family, the pollution of the environment, the destruction of everything that was right and holy and contributed to, you know, real good, not liberal good, but real Islamic good. Those are palpable things that people are actually experiencing.
Right.
And so what's going to step in and respond to it? Who's going to provide another way forward? I think that the Muslims are the best positioned. Even look just at the trans issue and all the stuff that's happening in schools. Who are the last people left to stand up and to face this? It's the Muslims, right? And so I do think we have a unique calling and a unique ability to be able to position ourselves. Does that mean that we're saving the liberal state? I don't know. Maybe we're providing a bridge to something else later on.
Okay.
You know, I don't care about saving liberalism or the liberal state, but there are real people, human beings with lives, you know, that live under these regimes. And a long view of history tells us that things come and go. And Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says that in the Quran. It's like we nudawil, like dawla comes from the word. It's like we're going to like make it, it's almost like a carousel, right? It's like here today, gone tomorrow. And so do we think that the United States of America is going to be here forever? No, it's not. United Kingdom? No, right? Is it always going to be a liberal state? Before that, it was the British Empire. Before that, it was something else. Before that, it was something else, right? So we might be living in a period where it's transitioning to something else, or not. Maybe we're living at a place where it's going to take a much longer transition time. The important thing is responding in a principled way, dutifully, to the society around us and trying to do the best that we can to do what pleases Allah and to bring as many people to the truth as possible.
What do you think of the discussion amongst, again, probably self-described modernist Muslims who argue that what we need is more liberalism. We need classical liberalism. We need to go back to that light touch liberalism where the state is not an enabling state. The state does not interfere in our lives, but the state stays away and really does allow us to be autonomous human beings. And in that context, we can be Muslims.
There's several problems with that take. One of them is that it's very nostalgic. And I don't like criticizing things on terms of nostalgia because the idea of nostalgia in and of itself is not problematic.
Yeah.
But the particulars to this nostalgia are problematic, which is that it's nostalgic for a time in which religious morals still had a significant force within society, yet the law was hands-off. So you'll find Muslims that even have this attitude towards like Iraq, like Ba'athist Iraq and stuff like that under Saddam. They'll say, you know, oh, you know, we had education, we were building things and the economy was good and life was still good. We didn't have these problems.
Yeah.
Well, there was a way in which, you know, secular liberal states capitalized on the residual culture of traditional societies and whether Muslim or Christian or whatever, that made the outcomes for that society much better. You know, morality still existed, okay? So there's a bit of nostalgia going on when people are looking back and saying, well, why can't we get back there? Well, the cat's out of the bag, you know, like Pandora's box has been opened and we can't easily or quickly get back to a scenario in which there's this residual sort of, you know, religious culture or religious morals or things like that, you know, that's happening. So that's the first thing. The second thing is that there's other things that, you know, they would have to account for the fact, well, why did we get here? Is this something we can simply hit the rewind button? Or is this something that this is a teleology. This is something that was sort of maybe not a foregone conclusion, but definitely a strong likelihood that things were going to unfold this way. That just like, you know, even back to the Greeks, you have, you know, Plato and Aristotle saying that, you know, you go from a certain system to then a military state, to then a democracy, and then to tyranny. You know, like that's the way that things go because, you know, something sort of plants the seed for the next stage to take over.
Yeah.
You know, so how are you saying that we can go back to that? You know, look
this
at
is,
where people...
Like Patrick Deneen's argument that the current, the modern liberal state isn't an aberration. It's actually the logical conclusion of what liberalism
and
is.
And I'm sympathetic to that view, and I agree with that view, actually. It's like you can't look at what progressives are claiming are necessary. Look at what they're claiming is harm and violence, right? They're telling us that simply not to affirm their whole conception of rights is violence on them and harm to them. How are we going to rewind that? We can't possibly rewind that. Like these are the claims, and polarization and all this sort of thing is already here, right? So instead of, it's funny, it's solely ironic that I'm making this critique because I can't stand this critique, you know, as, you know, in every situation. But in this situation, it fits. Like we have to think about how are we going to go forward, right? How are we going to solve the issues of society now? And we can't simply do it. Let's say this, in order to do it by quote unquote rewinding to this time of period where government was more hands off and we still had this residual, you know, religious reality, we would have to be in a situation that preceded that situation, right? Where we had centuries of strong religious rule, like structural religious involvement in, in government and in things like that. And then the sort of initial stages of a secularization process, where, you know, the government starts to be hands off and they're tinkering with what's the lowest common denominator that we can all agree upon and you know, supposedly sort of protect everybody's rights. We're way past that, right? And it's not clear to me that that's something that can be reversed, at least without, again, going back to the period that directly preceded that.
Can I ask you about your work with the Yakin Institute?
Yes.
Now, Yakin has a mission to address the doubts that have seeped into the Muslim community. Well, from our discussion today, it seems to me the elephant in the room is liberalism. Liberalism is probably the major cause, the major impediment that contributes to a Muslim becoming less faithful, becoming less inclined towards Islam. I don't really see, and maybe I haven't, you know, haven't searched hard enough, but I don't see an emphasis on debating and discussing the ideas of liberalism in the way you've done today, in a courteous way, in a way in which you elucidate its values and ideas, but you do it in a forthright way. Is that a discussion you're having within Yakin?
Oh, certainly, and everybody needs to do more. And there's several reasons for this. So you know, Yakin is doing a great job, alhamdulillah.
Yeah,
but it can be doing way more, and it has to be doing way more. If you compare Yakin Institute 2023 to Yakin Institute, you know, 2019 or 2018, big difference. Okay. Even the people that are involved, big difference in the people that are involved. A lot of really important changes have been made, and I've addressed this elsewhere for people who are interested.
Right.
But you're right. There is a paucity of taking liberalism head on, and there are reasons for that. Some of them are just bandwidth issues. Like I have a lot of stuff that I have to do. So it's like people need to have the time, you know, to get around to it.
Yeah.
But more important than that are you have many people who have internalized parts of liberalism, if not all of liberalism, and aren't aware of it. Okay. Especially Islamic studies departments, Western academic institutions, things like this.
Yes.
People study and they get degrees and no one is telling them the ways in which liberal values have shaped their education.
Yes.
Nobody is telling them the ways in which liberalism actually affects the way that they interact with Islam and the way in which they mine Islam for certain sort of evidences or outcomes and then deploy them in sort of, you know, the most obvious sort of situations when people are trying to demonstrate that Islam is compatible with modernity or compatible with liberalism or stuff like that, right? So there's a lack of self-awareness and there's a lack of a genealogy, what Foucault and his ilk would call a genealogy of this intellectual history, see where it's come from, et cetera, et cetera. But even before that, there's a paucity of Muslims that are doing social sciences and humanities, right? We have, I call it the holy trinity of doctor, lawyer, engineer.
Yeah.
If we're putting everybody into these three fields, you know, I'm the only one I know. You just told me about somebody else, you know, maybe the first other person I know who has a background in political theory and then went and did traditional studies, right? This is why we need people like this with this training to be able to put one and two together, to be able to look critically at these structures from an Islamic worldview perspective, right? And to be able to break them down and to be able to explain to people, right? And that's the other thing too. There are some people who have those credentials and abilities, but then being able to explain it to people is a whole other thing, right? And being able to communicate it, there's a lot of jargon involved. A lot of the Western Academy is predicated upon this exclusivity of knowledge where you're building up your jargon so that other people can understand. You put up the paywall, you know, so that's in order to exclusivity. It's like the diamond trade, right? It's just about trying to add that value, right? We need more propagandists. We need more people that are going to be able to explain it to the man on the street. What's wrong with liberalism? What's wrong with autonomy? What's wrong with free choice?
Yes.
Why is my hijab, my choice, a stupid thing to say,
right?
Or unless, okay, we don't want to be derogatory or mocking, but like a problematic and insufficient thing to say.
Yeah.
Actually something that actually undermines Islam,
yeah,
as opposed to something that strengthens it, despite what people think about it. Mm. So all of these things and more contribute. And, you know, Yaqeen is like any other, you know, organization that needs to go through this process when it comes to the personnel, attracting personnel, and producing work that's going to take this on. And that's partly why they brought me on. It's like to deal with these things in a more forthright way. So when it comes to tackling liberalism, we have our own podcast now, Dogma Disrupted, that is taking those things head on. There's going to be a short video series called Think Again that's going to be more incisive, 3 to 8 minute videos that are going to really confront some of these things, liberalism and otherwise, sort of the undergirding ideas of these things. Mm. But we need to have more papers. We need to have more people. We need to have more. You're 100% right.
And that's in progress. You're yes, working on it. Okay, very yes, good. Excellent. So one last question for you. And really, it's a question about the future of Muslims in the West. As the liberal state becomes more and more assertive, can we really be Muslims living under a liberal state?
I mean, again, because liberalism is such sort of a broad ideology, there is space to maneuver. Okay. And the irony of all ironies historically right now is that there's more space to maneuver in Western lands often than there is in the post-colonial states within the Muslim world.
Yeah.
Now, unfortunately, a lot of people misinterpret that fact and they say, well, look, liberalism is so great, secularism is so great. Mm. No, it's actually not attributable to secularism or liberalism that we have that freedom. Mm. You destabilized Muslim states.
Yes.
You're the ones that impose these autocrats. Yeah. You're the ones that keep them, you know, and punish them or reward them with military aid and other sorts of aid and political recognition and things like that. You know, you're the ones that took away what we had that opposed liberalism and was way better than liberalism in the first place, you know, but we are where we are. And so we have these kind of, you know, Frankenstein states in across the Muslim world that are extremely autocratic, extremely modern, right? Deep tentacles into society, centralized, controlling education, controlling the ulama, all the stuff that is very, very anti-Islamic. And there is a strain of liberalism or a sub-strain of liberalism that gives us a little bit of room to maneuver, right, in the West. Some places more than others.
Okay.
United States more than France.
Yes.
Right? Depending on, again, the various sort of sub-traditions within liberalism or what type of good is being emphasized or which tangible goods that they seek to deliver that the state decides that they're going to emphasize.
Yes.
While we have that opportunity, there's room to maneuver. Yes, we can. We have the freedom to establish institutions. We have the freedom to establish a waqf, right? A religious endowment that we don't have in the Muslim world in many places. We can establish an Islamic school, a private school that teaches all of what we want to teach, right? We have the ability to do that. We have the freedom to do that that we don't necessarily have. You can't just go to other places in the Muslim world and start up your own school and then, et cetera. So we have enough space to maneuver to establish ourselves in a very important and structural way. Yeah. The kicker is that we're not taking advantage of it. Right? We're concerned with the wrong things. We're looking to exercise the wrong rights. We're looking to capitalize on just the materialistic aspects of living in the West and, you know, having brand name clothing and, you know, more shoes than you know what to do with and a huge house in the suburbs and things like that. And we have completely neglected the responsibility of establishing independent Muslim scholarship, right? Can you imagine? You know, all of these sort of universities and madrasas and things that are under strict government control, like throughout the Muslim world,
yes,
we actually have the ability to make religious endowments, double blind donations, whatever we have to do to fund indigenous Muslim scholarship that is not controlled by any state interests. Mm. We have the ability to do that.
Yes.
And we haven't done it yet. Okay. We've only been at it for a little bit, but it's like, this is what has to be on our radar. Like we actually have the ability to do this thing. You know, we have certain tools when it comes to governance that, you know, if you look at places like Michigan or places that have, you know, Dearborn, et cetera, places that have, you know, a critical mass of Muslim population, you have the ability to control the school board. You have the ability to run for office and get elected and not have to compromise, right? And we're talking local level because once you get at this level where we're at, once you get, you know, more national, it becomes too problematic. You have to compromise.
Yes.
But we have enough room to maneuver. Our question is, are we using it in the right way? And that's a matter of sincerity. That's a matter of priorities. And unfortunately, we're not passing yet. And I hope, inshallah, that we turn it around and that we're able to use the space that's provided to us by the societies that we live in order to establish Islam in a meaningful way in a way that's going to survive liberalism and live past it. And the modern state and whatever, wherever we're at now, when the UK becomes something else, the United States of America becomes something else, as it inevitably will. This is not like, no one's calling for revolution, but it's just history, as it inevitably will. We want to have the institutions in place that are going to survive that.
Imam Tom Fakini, it's been a pleasure really speaking to you today. It's been an interesting discussion. Jazakallah khair for your time.
Amin wa yakum. Thank you so much again.
Please remember to subscribe to our social media and YouTube channels and head over to our website, thinkingmuslim.com, to sign up to my weekly newsletter. Jazakallah khair.
How would you like to look 5 years younger? In a clinical study, people that had volume added with Juvederm Voluma XC in the cheeks perceived themselves as looking 5 years younger at 6 months after treatment. Look younger, feel like you. Add volume for lift and contour in the cheeks with Juvederm Voluma XC. Reverse signs of aging by adding volume to smooth laugh lines with Juvederm Volure XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you. Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.